Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we talk with a reporter who covered the war in Vietnam, then after the war, lived in peacetime Hanoi. David Lam is a freelance correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and the author of Vietnam Now, A Reporter Returns. David Lam went to Vietnam in 1968 for United Press International. 29 years later, in 1997, he went back to open a bureau for the Los Angeles Times in Hanoi. He stayed in that post for 4 years. In Vietnam Now, A Reporter Returns, Lam says when he first went to Vietnam as a young reporter, he understood shamefully little about the country's history, culture, and people. And he says when he left Vietnam in the 70s, he left without a shred of remorse. He says, quoting here, he cared not if he had saw the wretched country again. He says he got on with his life. We'll talk with David Lam about why he went back and what he learned during the years he lived in Hanoi. Listeners, you can join the discussion with your questions. I look forward to hearing from you. Here are the telephone numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. David Lam is the author of 6 books. His latest, Vietnam Now, is published by Public Affairs Books. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. David Lam, good afternoon. Welcome.
And good afternoon to you, too, Celeste. It's nice to be with you.
You own up to knowing little about Vietnam when you went in 1968. You had 2 weeks' notice you were going. Were you able to do any research about the country before setting off?
No, I really didn't do much besides pack my bags and say goodbye to my family and start worrying about myself. But no, I did not have a chance to do any research, and it's too bad. It's a shame.
Yeah. What were your expectations in 1968? You were a very young man.
I was. I was 28 then, and my expectations were fearfulness. It was the first war I had ever covered. I'd covered many since then, but it was the first one I'd covered, and I was scared to death. And I just wanted to know how I was going to survive, and I had absolutely no idea what my life was going to be like there.
Yeah. Why did you want to go if you were fearful?
Well, I think everybody of my generation, every journalist wanted to cover that war. I mean, it was the great story of our generation. It affected everything. It's still seared into our psyche to this day. It was just journalistic inquisitiveness that wanted to make me go. And I think every journalist, particularly males, somehow in the back of their mind are wondering, what would it be like to cover a war? And can I stand up? You know, can I cut the mustard? And I think that was part of it, too.
Yeah. You were a battlefront correspondent for 2 years.
I sure was.
Yeah. What was your life like?
It was weird. I spent most of my time, we had about a dozen reporters for UPI in country then. I spent most of my time based out of Da Nang, which was in the Central Highlands, and I was hanging out with the two Marine divisions up there who were stretched out from basically Da Nang up to the DMZ. And I'd go out for a week, 2 weeks at a time, and stay with one unit if there was military action going on. Of course, those were the days of telexes and typewriters. We didn't have faxes then, and certainly not computers. And one of the biggest problems you had was just once you got the information, was just getting it back to the bureau in Saigon so they could send it out to Hong Kong so it could get back to New York and be distributed on the UPI wire.
Mm. Well, what led you to the feelings you had about Vietnam when you left the country in 1970?
Probably the best answer is ignorance, and I think that is one widely reflected by the vast majority of Americans from that era, whether it was in the administration or the military or journalists. We knew almost nothing about the country of Vietnam, its history, its language, its culture, and we knew just as little about the Vietnamese. We had no idea, particularly the North Vietnamese, their level of endurance, their deep sense of nationalism, and I just I knew so little about the country then.
Yeah, and it's still the same situation, isn't it?
Well, I think we're learning. I think things have changed. A lot of tourists are going to Vietnam now, a lot of American businessmen. I think we're putting the ignorance behind us, frankly, and I sure hope we are.
Yeah. Well, what's Hanoi like today?
Oh, Hanoi is a truly wonderful city. When I settled in there in 97, I'd never seen Vietnam. Hanoi, my whole time during the war had obviously been spent south of the DMZ, and I had this image of Hanoi, the old-time, quote, enemy capital, end quote. I sort of thought of it as it would probably look like one of those grim, gray, drab Eastern European cities from the communist days, and Hanoi is anything but that. It is a most aesthetically pleasing city I've perhaps ever seen in the world. It's got the whiff of French colonial architecture. It's got wide tree-lined boulevards. Yeah, there are 11 lakes downtown. It's got all the amenities you'd want now in terms of you can buy almost anything there. There are good hotels, good restaurants. And still you have this wonderful feeling that you're kind of sitting on a frontier or a country and a city that's in transition. My wife and I didn't have a car. We just had bicycles. And every day we joined about a million other Hanoians on the ride to work. And not having to have a car and being able to get around everywhere on a bicycle was really one of the joys of the 4 years I spent there.
Yeah. Now, Hanoi, when you went to live there in 1997, was very different place from what it was in the years immediately after the war. And yeah. you talk about the transformation of Vietnam after the war, from going from real hardship and hard scrabble life to now this place of where there's a real sense of possibility.
There sure is that. And, of course, I didn't. The really grim years, the dark years for Vietnam were the decade after the war, 75 to 85, when the government was full of communist ideological fervor, when wealth and property was confiscated, when economic zones were set up, and all of this proved to be an absolute disaster. And I never saw Hanoi from 75 to 85, but I sure was intrigued in the many conversations I had with Hanoians that lived through that era, what the city was like. And it was truly like that grim, drab Eastern European city I had expected. There was no traffic on the street except an occasional Russian truck rumbling by. There were no businesses. There wasn't a beauty salon. There were two traffic lights in town. Everybody was poor and hungry. It sounded like about as grim a place as I could imagine, Celeste, in that era.
Yeah. Well, then here's the question, you know, how did the country get from then to now?
Big step forward. And it really happened as a result of their disastrous policies that followed the war. The loss of the best and the brightest who fled as boat people, many of whom are in the United States now, and Vietnam's wall back was to the wall by the mid-1980s. It has these two great rice baskets, the Mekong Delta in the south and the Red River Delta in the north, and yet Vietnam had become a importer of rice. Famine was threatening. People were starving. People were extremely discontent, and the government took a look at what China was doing, moving towards a free market economy, and they knew they had to do something not only to stay in power, but also if the country of Vietnam was to have any economic viability at all. And they instituted a program that they call Doi Moi, or open door policy, and this policy slowly moved Vietnam not towards a capitalistic system, but towards joining the world, the global community's free market economy. And the results were absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah. Well, the influence of the Communist Party has declined.
It sure has, although it's still substantial. But it has declined until the policy of the open door policy came into effect. And it really, although it was adopted in 86, it really didn't start to be implemented until the early 90s. And the changes have been quite phenomenal. The young kids now, where a decade ago they would have had to have joined the Communist Party to progress in any career, even if they wanted to be an artist, they would have to be a party member so that the People's Committee would sponsor an art show or a gallery for them. Now, increasingly, the kids realize that they can survive on their own talent. And the Communist Party I think basically it's irrelevant to the vast majority of the young Vietnamese. But that said, if you asked any of these 20-year-olds or 30-year-olds on the street, are you a communist, they would probably say yes. But what they mean is not that I believe in the Marxist ideology. It would mean that I'm a nationalist. In Vietnam, nationalism and communism, in the mind's eye, is so closely interwoven that the people really don't separate the two. They look on the Communist Party and Ho Chi Minh and the People's Army, having been at the forefront of bringing independence and reunification. And so for the average Vietnamese now, nationalism and communism are almost interchangeable mm-hmm. phrases.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I was struck by, somebody you talked with really came through with this kind of idea that you've just been expressing. He said, you know, my father wants me to become a member of the Communist Party, but that was in his time. In my time, if I am a nationalist, he didn't use that word, but if I am a good Vietnamese, and if I am of service to my country, then I will do fine.
I remember the young man that told me that, and in fact, it's interesting. He ended up studying here at John Hopkins Medical University for 2 years and has now gone back to Vietnam. And I think a lot of the kids do feel that way, although the sacrifices their parents made for independence and during the war doesn't resonate with them as much as one might think it would. And after all, 60% of Vietnam's population was born mm-hmm. after the last American left Vietnam. But I think there really still is a sense of wanting to be of service to the country in the young generation. And this is really something that the Communist Party ingrained in people. And although I'm no fan of communism, I think it's the greatest failed social and economic experiment of the 20th century. But one of the good things it did do was to ingrain in people a sense of service to the country. And I think that feeling is very much there with the young Vietnamese. They're as much nationalist as their parents were in a very different way, but they still do have a deep sense of nationalism. And I think Vietnam is one of the proudest, most nationalistic nations I've ever encountered.
Mm. In addition to having this baby boom after the war, where you've got most of the population, 60% of the Vietnamese population born after the last Americans went home, as you just mentioned, we've got that going for the country. And then also, it seems that the people who survived the war are very hopeful and have great hopes for their children and grandchildren.
There's absolutely no doubt about it. And there are a couple of obvious reasons. One, after so many years of warfare, and it wasn't just the 10 years with us, it was the French War started in 54, so you're really talking of 20 years of fairly constant warfare. And then when the war ended and everybody was so hopeful that, okay, the future's here now, this grim dark period of the dark years set in from 1975 to 1985, that life was so terrible there in Vietnam at that time, then what that what they're going through now truly is a renaissance, that these are the golden years for these people who had been through so many, many tough times. And occasionally they would run polls in Vietnam. One was even taken by our U.S. Information Agency, which was then an arm of the State Department. And the polls constantly showed that 80% of the population believed that their life was going to be better tomorrow than it is today, that their kids were going to have a better life than they themselves had had, that life was getting better, right down the line. And the government has huge problems and challenges and obstacles, one of the most pressing being that it's got to create a million jobs a year because there are so many school leavers. But as long as the kids' aspirations are being fulfilled, as long as their expectations aren't raised unrealistically high, the Vietnamese are going to be hopeful and confident of the future. But if their aspirations go unmet and engineers can't get jobs and English graduates end up only working as tour guides and liberal arts graduates end up driving a taxi cab or not working at all, then the government is going to have deep, deep problems.
Mm. One of the fascinating people you met and you write about in the book Vietnam Now is a person you met not long after you arrived. And I think this is the grandmother of the person we mentioned a moment ago who's been to Johns Hopkins for training and then gone back to Vietnam. Mrs. Nguyen, and forgive me if I'm brutalizing
this. Right.
Mrs. Nguyen Trí Nghệ.
You do quite well.
Okay. A 93-year-old woman.
Yeah.
Tell us about her.
Well, her family was intrigued me because it really became, I thought, the symbol for my understanding of the war. It was a family like so many others that had been divided by the war and divided by the DMZ. One of her sons, they had lived just south of the DMZ during the French colonial times and then when the American War started. They were up by a town called Dong Ha, and maybe 10 miles from the DMZ, which was one of the areas of one of the heaviest fightings during the Vietnam War. One of their sons had gone north over the Ben Hai River as a young man, as a young teenager. I think he was 12 or 13 years old. The other two sons had stayed in the south with the family. The young man had gone north because his father had sent him north, not knowing a single person north of the DMZ, but believing his son would get a better education in the north and probably be safer from the war. This was the three smartest of the kids. And for at least 10 years during the war, there was no communications over the DMZ between north and south. And the family never knew if one member was alive or what had happened to the others. And the young man that went north became one of the most accomplished surgeons in Hanoi and in what was North Vietnam, is now obviously now just Vietnam. I returned with him to the family home, which is still near the DMZ, to meet his mother, who was 93 and still in good shape mentally and physically. And his two brothers that had fought for the South came to this reunion, and I came down with Dr. Nee, who had been a surgeon during the war in the North. And it was one of the more moving experiences I had encountered during my 4 years in Vietnam, to see this family that had been divided by the war and then reunited by the peace. And, you know, they didn't talk about the war anymore. The brothers didn't say, well, what was it like fighting for the South while I was up in the North as a surgeon tending to the military wounded? They simply put that part behind them. They didn't have strong ideological bent, particularly the two young men who are now grown adults from the South. It was only myself that wanted to talk about the war. They didn't.
Mm. Journalist David Lamb is our guest this afternoon. He's the author of Vietnam Now, A Reporter Returns. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name's Celeste Quinn. Listeners, your questions and comments are welcome. 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. A listener is waiting to talk with us on the toll-free line in Chicago. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I find this very interesting. I have two questions for your guest. One, now that the war has been over all this time, it's been over about 26 years, I guess. Well, 27, actually. How do the Vietnamese feel about Americans? Do they like them? Do they dislike them? That's one. And two, how do you feel about Robert McNamara's coming out in 1996 and saying the whole thing was a mistake, never should have happened?
On the first question, that was one of on how Americans are viewed there. That was one of the major surprises I have had. And boy, every American that comes there, whether he's a businessman, a tourist, or a returning GI, has the same gee whiz response. It's gee whiz because the Vietnamese welcoming of Americans is so gracious, so heartfelt, so warm that it absolutely defies explanation. I interviewed a woman who lost five sons in what the Vietnamese call the American War. And you know what she said to me? She said, "I wish my husband was alive today to see you sitting here at the kitchen table. He'd be so honored to have an American here. Thank you for caring." And looking for an explanation for this, I guess the best one I can give you was something that was expressed to me by a cab driver in Hanoi one day, when I found out he had fought for the North, as virtually every friend I had in Hanoi over the age of 50 had participated in the war. And I said to him, I said, "Geez, I'm an American. Why don't you hate me?" He thought for a minute and he said, "You know, we fought the Chinese for 1,000 years. We fought the French colonialists for over 100. We were occupied by Japan during World War II. You were only here 10 years. You were just a blip in our history." And I really think that is an honest explanation for how many, if not most, Vietnamese feel. And another thing that figures into it is that the Vietnamese were told over and over and over by Ho Chi Minh during the war that the American people are not your enemy or not our enemy. The American government is. And so that attitude carries through to Vietnam today. And then there's also a pragmatic reason. The Vietnamese want economic development. They want tourist dollars. They want foreign investment. And to see Americans coming back is a sign to them that the grim, dark years after the war are over, that Vietnam has rejoined the international community, and that America and the United States and Vietnam now have very, very good relations. On Robert McNamara's book, it struck me as a tragedy, as it did so many others, that the obvious reaction was, if you felt that way, that the war was wrong during the war, my God, why didn't you stand up? You were Secretary of Defense. Why didn't you help stop it? I don't have a lot of... I guess I can sympathize as a human being the turmoil he probably goes through now, but it was a pretty hard admission to digest for me what he had in that book.
Well, 58,000 dead. I mean, that's is it true that in 1945 an OSS team went to Hanoi and Ho Chi Minh proposed that we become friends and allies?
Absolutely. We were helping Ho Chi Minh's forces during the Japanese occupation. There are great stories as part of history, and many of them are in my book, on what Ho Chi Minh really thought that he had a good chance of becoming very good friends with the United States. This is in the 40s, because he thought, gee, the United States is not a colonial nation, is one that stands up for the morality and favors the little guy. And he reached out 100 ways. We ignored him, and, you know, at times obviously were different then. He was a communist. The Cold War was going on or was about to start. there was, unfortunately, or whatever the proper adverb is, but there was no way we were going to do business with anybody that was a communist. But you can't help, if you're thinking of trying to rewrite history, you can't help but thinking or wondering how different the world would have been had we not rejected Ho Chi Minh's overtures and had we not perhaps reached out to some of the liberation movements that had a very strong moral leg to stand on, whether it was in Vietnam or Africa or any of them. And, of course, it was the Soviet Union that supported all those liberation movements, and the world became a very different place.
Well, 58,000 dead would not have been dead if we had done that.
That's very possible. And, you know, that figure is such an overwhelming one to us, and all the grieving we have done for all the Americans who died in Vietnam. But there is a figure that ought to be thrown out, and I'd be remiss if I didn't. We have mourned so long for our 58 dead. Do you know Vietnam, North and South, civilian and military, lost 3 million people in the American war? And in a comparison on a per capita basis between our two countries, that would be the equivalent of the United States losing 27 million people during those 10 years. Absolutely, I mean, it's breathtaking.
Tragedy.
A tragedy for all concerned, and I think we all agree today that hindsight is easy, but the war was a tragedy for us. It was a tragedy for Vietnam. It was a tragedy for the world, and one knocks on wood and just says, I hope we've learned our lessons.
Well, hopefully so.
Hopefully so.
I'll get off. I know there's other people who probably want to get on. I just wanted to say it's different from the Korean War where you had a clear aggression, but I don't think this one had to happen.
I think you can make a real strong case for that it didn't have to happen. But, of course, hindsight is always easy. But, you know, when I started the conversation with Celeste talking about my own ignorance in Vietnam when I went there as a combat correspondent in 68, and then when I suggested that ignorance was shared by the American public, the American administration, all those involved with the war, to a large extent, that ignorance is what got us bogged down in Vietnam, because we never understood the country, we never understood the people. And, my gosh, how can you commit to waging war against a country and an entity of which you really have absolutely no idea what they are?
I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon and invite others to join us with their questions and comments. 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, call us toll-free, 800-222-9455. If you're just joining us this afternoon, our guest is journalist David Lamb. He spent a number of years in Vietnam, two as a battlefront correspondent from 1968 to 1970. He went back in 1975 to cover the fall of Saigon. And then in 1997, he went back to open a bureau for the Los Angeles Times in Hanoi, and he stayed in that post for 4 years. He's written a book about his experiences going back. Vietnam Now, A Reporter Returns. 333-9455, 800-222-9455, the numbers to call this afternoon if you'd like to join the discussion. The caller, you and the caller talked a little bit about Ho Chi Minh. I was wondering, is there a good biography of him in English?
There's a wonderful one, and boy, I'm embarrassed. I can't think of who wrote it. It's called Ho Chi Minh, and it was published about 2 years ago by a former State Department officer who then became an author and is a true scholar, and it's a wonderfully readable book on one of the legendary political figures of the 20th century. And certainly on any website or anything, if you plugged in Ho Chi Minh, you would come up with a biography, and I highly recommend it. He was an absolutely fascinating individual.
Mm. The veterans who were wounded, who were disabled in the war, how have they fared?
You mean the Vietnamese?
Yeah.
Yeah. Really interesting question, because I went back one day to what would be the equivalent of a VA hospital. And it was so different than what I had seen in the United States when I had visited VA hospitals. first of all, it really sort of physically it looked like kind of a motel, a sprawling complex of one-story buildings, dormitories, and two people to a room. And these were people that were paraplegics, were in wheelchairs as a result of the Vietnam War. A whole village had grown up around this medical complex, and the complex and the village were really integrated together, where the little kids from the village would come over and they would call the veterans uncle and they would play games with the vets and sit in their wheelchairs. And there was such a warm, humanistic feeling to it that there was none of the sterile isolation that one feels in a VA hospital here in the United States. And I think that helps to explain why everything I saw would indicate that the Vietnamese veterans or wounded veterans have adjusted better to the war generally than many of our own soldiers have.
Hmm. And the situation of the children of American soldiers?
Most of them, well, the Amerasians, that was a real problem, but almost all of them have been resettled in the United States. But there is a small, to this day, there is still a small group that's stranded in the Philippines. And they got to the Philippines because the United States and Vietnam signed an agreement some years back that we would take all the Amerasian kids. So the United States airlifted them out to the Philippines, which was to be a temporary transit point for them before they and their mothers got to the United States. Well, for various reasons, during the interviews in the Philippines, the United States decided that some of these people, the adults, not the more often than the younger kids, and those kids aren't young anymore, they're in their 20s or whatever, but the United States decided that they were not socially acceptable to the United States. Maybe they had been involved with fighting, drunkenness in the Philippines. Maybe they had lied in their application and tried to bring along some other friends allegedly as family members when they weren't family members. So the United States revoked their visa to come to the United States. Vietnam won't take them back because Vietnam says, look, they left legally on this U.S. program to bring them out. The Philippines doesn't want them because they said, the Philippines said, look, they would have come here for a couple of months as a transit point, and now they've been here several years. So they're really in limbo, but there's a wonderful young Vietnamese-Australian young man who became a great friend, Hoi Trinh, and he is an attorney, and he is working pro bono to get all of these Amerasians resettled. And one by one, he's doing it. Some are going to Australia. Some are still coming to the United States. And one by one by one, he's getting this group resettled into a third country.
Yeah. In that chapter in the book, you also talk about another remarkable person who is a former television producer, Lan I Trinh.
Yes, she was one of the ones that had, like so many, had come back to sort of discover her roots. And she was of Chinese heritage. And after the war ended, Vietnam had a very unpleasant crackdown on Chinese Vietnamese. And many of them became boat people. Some fled into China. But China didn't want them because China and Vietnam, their relationship was very dicey after the war, and traditionally has been dicey for 1,000 years. So she and her family, and her mother, got trapped on the bridge between China and Vietnam, and China wouldn't let them in, and Vietnam wouldn't let them back. And as I recall, she spent a couple of months there. She's now come back to Ho Chi Minh City, as formerly what was Saigon, and is writing her family memoirs, which should make an exceptionally interesting book. It's interesting that an awful lot of the young overseas Vietnamese who escaped in 1975 with their families, who left as boat people in the 1980s, a lot of them are coming back now. Even though they're thoroughly westernized, they're coming back to discover their roots in Vietnam. And some are staying as businessmen, some are staying as teachers. Most just come for visits to see old family members, but there are a surprising number that are staying around. They've still got the American passport, so they can leave if they want to, but there are an amazing number who have come back to become part of the Vietnamese community.
And what's the reception been like for those people?
Pretty good. They come back in a way with two strikes against them, though. The government doesn't quite trust them until at least they prove their trustworthiness, although the government is very anxious that these people come back because they've got a great deal of knowledge and business expertise that could be shared in the development of Vietnam. But that said, since so many of the overseas Vietnamese are critical of the communist government in Hanoi, the government remains a little critical of these people or suspicious of these people coming back. And when they go into the villages to find their cousins that they may not have seen for years, there is a little bit of, I think, resentment on the part of those who stayed behind because they look at the Vietnamese Americans or Vietnamese Australians coming back. They probably have an education now. They probably have a good job and a dollar in their pocket, and out in the countryside at least, their country cousins are still probably on the same plot of farming land that the family's been on for umpteen generations. And the people that stayed behind have to look at their city cousins from the United States and say, gee, I wonder what would have happened to me if I'd made that same journey across the ocean that my cousin did. And one other thing that figures into that, the returning Vietnamese are apt to come back with a touch of arrogance, perhaps, to walk with a bit of a swagger. And it's interesting, they're no longer on a rice diet, so they're bigger than the average Vietnamese. They're heavier. Many of them haven't used chopsticks for years, have forgotten how to use chopsticks. Many of them don't speak the Vietnamese language fluently because they haven't spoken it at home in Orange County or wherever for many, many years. So it takes a while for the returning Vietnamese to develop a trust with the Vietnamese who have stayed, and it takes a while for the returnees to really become part of the Vietnamese community.
Mm. You know, the old guard has got to be really old now and dying out. What's the political landscape in Vietnam today? Who's moving ahead in politics?
Well, being a communist country, almost everything is done behind closed doors. The real power still rests with the Politburo, which is a group of 17 to 19, almost all male, almost all elderly, probably over 70. People who came of age during the wars against France and the United States. And I think these people found it probably a lot easier to fight the war than they have to capitalize on the peace. I think in many ways some of them hark back to the past, not that they, God forbid, ever want war again, but hark back to the past and that life was really simpler then because everybody had a single focus in the North, and that was to sacrifice for the nation. And now the young people are making demands. They want economic opportunity. They want to make sure they get a good education. Life's not so simple now, and the old guard clings to the reins of power, but they see that, and mind you, also the perks that go with power, but the old guard sees that they don't have the sway over the youth the way they used to, that the youth aren't joining the Communist Party in great numbers anymore, that communism for most of the Vietnamese young is largely irrelevant, but there's certainly no indication yet that the mantle of leadership is being passed to a younger, newer generation with fresh ideas, although heaven knows that young generation in Vietnam is immensely competent and thirsting for knowledge, and this is the first post-war generation. It was always hard for me to realize that these kids 20 years ago were standing in line with their ration cards waiting for their sack of rice, and now they have cell phones, and they're getting educated, and they've got incredible inquisitiveness and a thirst for knowledge. A lot of them start their second university degree before they finish the first, and if they've got a day job, they're all studying English at night. This was an immensely likable generation for whom I had really great admiration.
We've got to wrap up pretty quickly here, but before we go, I want to ask you about, if this goes back to how do the Vietnamese talk about the war, the American war? Because this is quite interesting to me. You write, they didn't write books about the war. Veterans don't gather over beers to talk about it. School children study it as only a brief page in the country's 2,500-year history. And when it comes to monuments and statues, there are few to none symbolizing Vietnam's victory. There's a memorial to the country's war dead, apparently. There's a war museum, and then there's Ho Chi Minh's corpse. And the cover of your book, the jacket, features a view in a wax museum, I believe.
Yes.
You know, when you go into those places, like, let's say, the memorial, you see the memorial or the war museum, how is that blip of history recorded?
Well, the war museum, there's one in Hanoi and there's one in Ho Chi Minh City, i.e. Saigon. That would not be where you would go to do any serious research. It is certainly a single-focused take from the Vietnamese perspective, the North Vietnamese perspective, and that is that the Americans did nothing good in Vietnam, that they were all killers, but it's a fascinating adventure to go through the museum for an American or for a Vietnamese, in that there are memories of everything from My Lai and the massacre there to the Christmas bombing in 1972, and a lot about Ho Chi Minh. It's a really interesting exercise, but I certainly wouldn't go there if I was a serious academic researcher wanting to really find what had gone on and was looking for archival material. It's certainly only the take of North Vietnam from one perspective, and fair enough, they suffered tremendously, and fair enough. I certainly don't begrudge them for that.
Yeah. But it's interesting that there's that take on the war, and then it seems, though, generally, you know, your reception was so warm, and the war hasn't been forgotten, but America's been forgiven.
Very definitely. If America's been forgiven, even if the war has not been forgotten. And, of course, for so many years, we viewed Vietnam as a war and not a country. And one of my great joys in going back was to peacetime Hanoi, was to discover a country and not a war, and to learn all that I never understood before about the culture and the great artistic heritage of these people as poets, as artists, as writers. And going back, for me, it wasn't so much rediscovering a country, because I don't think I ever discovered Vietnam when I was there as a combat correspondent in the 60s. For me, going back was the discovery of a brand new country, something I hadn't seen before.
We'll have to leave it there because we're out of time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Celeste. It's a pleasure to be with you.
David Lam has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. Look for his book, Vietnam Now, A Reporter Returns. It's published by Public Affairs Books.